Oh, you're the introducer. Okay.
Sure.
Okay. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Belkowitz. For those who don't know him, probably everybody knows him anyway. So Dr. Belkowitz is a named chair in the psychology and Jewish education in Azrieli, and he's been at North Shore LIJ and NYU for many years. I've been shared many graduations with him over the years, and he's written extensively, very well known, and I don't think I have to go through everything else, but we're thrilled to have Dr. Belkowitz.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. Yeah, what I'm going to speak about is the bridge between moral knowledge and moral action. So talking about in terms of, with the theme of parenting is, let me explain it. I'll start it with a story, okay? It's a story that some of you may have heard from me, but let me start with it because I think it'll bring the focus for the half hour that we have together to, with some clarity. The story of Dr. Coles, a professor he's a psychiatrist who's written a lot about moral and ethical development. So he taught for many years a series of three courses at Harvard. There are three sequential courses on ethics and moral development. He had a woman in his class who was the first woman in her town from Western Pennsylvania. It was a dirt poor coal town in Western Pennsylvania. Nobody in that town had ever gone to college, let alone gone to Harvard. And she got a partial scholarship to Harvard. And the town was so incredibly proud of her that they had a marching band that escorted her down the main street of the town and escorted her to the train station where she took the train that made its way ultimately up to Boston, the Boston area. She took the three courses in moral and ethical development that Dr. Coles gave. And she did very well. She aced the courses. And he was shocked when she knocked on his door one day after she took the three courses to say, "Dr. Coles, I wanted to thank you for all you've done for me, but I also wanted to let you know that I'm leaving Harvard." So he was shocked. He says, "Everybody's so proud of you. How could you be leaving? You were a super student, an amazing student. Everybody was so amazed with your story." She said, "Tell me who got the highest grades. Who was ranked number one in all three classes?" And he immediately said, "Well, we know who it is." And he said, they evidently posted the names and the ranking of everybody in the class. And it was the name of somebody from a very famous family that was so famous that the last name was on many of the buildings on the Harvard campus. And she said, "Right, he ranked number one in all three classes." She said, "Let me tell you something." She said, "My partial scholarship only allows me to pay for some of my expenses, so I have to work. So every night I go and I clean a different apartment, either on campus or off campus." And this man, who ranked number one in all three classes, this man actually was one of the people who employed me. So I'd go on a regular basis to his apartment, and when I'd go to his apartment, he would do everything he could to demean me. Everything he could to demean me. He would, with all his friends, would make fun of me. They'd have me do these horrible tasks. They'd basically make fun of my poverty. Then she stands up and she says, "Dr. Coles, any institution that has such a disconnect between moral knowledge and moral action, I don't want to be a part of." And she leaves and he never sees her again. I'm going to go through five ingredients that my understanding of the research is that talks about how to bridge that gap. Hard to do it with any kind of justice in a brief half-hour talk, but I'll start with the first one, and many of these are going to be informed by some fascinating research by Dr. Sam Oliner. Dr. Sam Oliner is a fascinating man. He's a professor of sociology, an author, respected researcher. But listen to his life. When he was a little boy, the Nazis killed his entire family, his parents, his siblings, his grandparents. And he was left all alone as a little boy. And he went on his own to a farm near where he grew up. And he just knocked on the door and he said, "Can you take me in?" And they knew who he was. They knew he was Jewish. And they took him in at risk to their lives and to the lives of their children. And they saved him, totally saved him throughout the war. And when he was liberated, he then devoted his entire professional life to interviewing and doing research, comparing people like that, the people who saved him, comparing righteous Gentiles to a comparison group of the neighbors who didn't. And he did intensive interviewing. And a lot of what I'm going to be talking about between now and, I guess, a quarter to two is what are some of the ingredients he found in these heroes? What differentiated a hero from a regular bystander? And the first one, which is one that I'll probably spend a fair amount on, is they're all going to start with the letter E. That's just a gimmick, just to, you know, give you a hook to hang it on. But it's the E of explanation. What he found throughout every family of a righteous Gentile who he interviewed was that the rules they set up in their homes was very much characterized, not by arbitrary authority, but was characterized by explaining, helping the kids understand why it is that they have to have certain values. Sort of like what we do when we talk about Menschlichkeit, what we do when we talk about our Bein Adam, emphasis on Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And they always framed it in a way that it was universal. You have to be this way to everybody. And they spent a lot of time imparting the values in a very conscious way. So if a kid messed up, they wouldn't get hit. They wouldn't get yelled at. They wouldn't even necessarily get criticized. The parents would patiently sit with them and say, "Look, we expect better of you. Let's talk about how this violates what we believe in as a value." So there was clarity about that. The second part of that ingredient was restitution, so that the kids growing up in those homes had to make restitution, meaning if they somehow hurt somebody's feelings, or they broke something that belonged to somebody, or they did anything wrong, the parents would talk about how this violates our family bumper stickers. But the parents would also talk about, well, how could you do tshuva? What could you do different? You know, there's a fascinating study. It's a study that I don't know how it was ever ethically done. I'm not very proud as a psychologist of my colleagues who did this study, but listen to what they do. They take a group of four-year-old boys. Imagine a four-year-old boy is sitting in the psychologist's office, and the psychologist has like an antique model car sitting on his desk. And he tells the kid, "You see this car? This is my favorite toy growing up. I love it." And then the psychologist thinks of an excuse to leave the room. He says, "Look, you know, you could play with the car. Just be careful not to break it. But you could play with the car. It's a great, great toy." So they videotape the four-year-olds as they play with the car, but the car is rigged to break. Okay? Not so nice, okay? And they videotape what the kid does afterwards. Then the psychologist comes back, and they explain to them that this was just an experiment, but what the kids did in response to breaking the toy predicted their future Menschlichkeit. So what I mean by that is some kids felt terrible. They do everything they could to fix the toy. They did everything they could to try to make restitution. Even though they were only four, they recognized that they did something wrong and they had to own it and they had to fix it. And other kids just, you know, they said, "Well, this is a piece of junk. It broke right away." And they then followed these kids over the next couple of years, and they found that the kids who accepted responsibility for what they did and try to make restitution, they in general seem to be really decent, empathic kids who would internalize the values that they grew up with. The second part of this first E, is the E of ethical fading. What I mean by ethical fading, so I'm talking about the research on neuroethics at Harvard. I'm not going to go into it in any great detail, but this is where they look at what parts of the brain light up when people have different ethical challenges. So you have an ethical challenge. If I ask everybody in this room, what's the right thing to do in certain situations? You're going on the Long Island Railroad, you have a 10-year-old kid, and let's say they're 10 years old and one day. And you have to start paying for your ticket at age 10 and up, if I remember correctly. I don't know, is that still the cutoff here? At least in Great Neck, that's the cutoff.
10 months today.
Huh?
It's probably 10 months
today. Yeah, right. Right, things change. But so the idea is, you know, if you're taking your kid on the train when he or she is exactly 10 years old, are you going to tell the truth or not tell the truth? Seems like a simple thing. When you go into Disney World, are you going to tell the truth or not tell the truth? When you go into a movie, whatever it is, how truthful are you about things when you have negius, when you have self-interest? And the bottom line here is that research shows very different parts of the brain light up when you are having to make different kinds of decisions. If I ask you what's the right thing to do in such a situation, everybody knows the right thing to do. If you're talking about somebody else, we tend to be very judgmental, very clear. The part of the brain that lights up is the thinking perspective part of the brain, where men put their shalrosh on every weekday morning, and that's very clear. But let's say it's a situation, we're on an interview for a job, and there's no way for your future employer to know how much you make in your current job. And they ask you, how much should you make in your current job? The part of the brain that lights up there is a much more emotional part of the brain, and what the researchers show is something called ethical fading takes place. Ethical fading is this: as soon as there's self-interest, adam karov etzel atzmo, we tend to fade in terms of our understanding of what the right thing is to do. So during morally challenging events, these researchers find we see the trees rather than the forest, details rather than abstract principles. We make quick decisions based on immediate feelings rather than calculated thought. Okay? So you remember that point of choice is a constant challenge that we have. How do we deal with that with our kids when we're raising them? Is we have them bring voice to values. We constantly review with them and with ourselves, what would I do in such a situation? And when you think about it and you prepare for it, hey, when I go for this job interview, I'm going to tell the truth no matter what. When I go to Disney World, I'm going to tell the truth about how old my child is, even if they're exactly at the cutoff point, okay? And when you think about it, and really review it, it just makes it much more likely that you're going to be able to do the right thing. I play a game with my grandchildren called Ethical Moral Dilemma. It may sound a little weird and the kind of thing that grandchildren of psychologists are doomed to have, but they love it. They love it. They torture me. Every time they come to our house for a Shabbos, who's going to be the first one to play Moral Dilemma? And I share with them moral dilemmas from my own life, you know, in a way that obviously is robbed of any identifying information. And then they've learned to share with me their own moral dilemmas. And there's something about it that speaks to the kids. So I had a true nachas moment over Shavuos. Some of my grandchildren were with us for Shavuos at the YU Shavuos program at the, at the Hilton in Westchester. And my granddaughter comes running over. She's about 8 years old, and my oldest granddaughter. And she goes running to my daughter and says, Ima, I have a moral dilemma. I have a moral dilemma, okay? In the camp here, in the day camp, all the kids got together in the camp that the program had, and they're saying that we should play a joke on the counselors and not listen to them. Basically, they were going on strike. She said, I want to do it because I really like these kids, and they're so much fun, and I think I could be friendly with them after Yontif. But she said, but it doesn't seem right. What do you think I should do? So my daughter talked it out with her, and she ended up, thank God, you know, doing the right thing. And she told the kids, look, I'm not going to do it. And I think they really viewed her as, you know, I'm sure it did not help her social standing. But it was real nachas, okay? You know, the idea of giving voice to value. So that's the answer. So again, it's explanation. And under that's the E of explanation. It's modeling restitution, and it's also being aware of giving voice to values as an antidote to the ethical fading that otherwise takes place. So that's the first part. Next part. The next part is the E. Obvious, but I have to talk about it just for a minute. The E of eye contact and empathy. What Olinger found in his research was the importance of being taught empathy, being taught to be nosei ba'olam chavera, being taught to feel for the other. And it's hard to do that today. It's much harder to do that today because our attention is constantly being challenged by you know, by our various digital kinds of devices. There's something that an author in this area calls continuous partial attention. Our attention is always drawn into, like, you know, maybe I should check that email or that text. And anything that competes for our attention is going to impact on empathy. If I showed you two videos now, and one video was a video of somebody having a car door slammed on their finger, everybody here would wince with empathy. You wouldn't have to think about it. But if the second video was a video of somebody being socially excluded or emotionally abused, you wouldn't have an immediate response of empathy because that requires attention. And I'll just, even though I could talk to you about this for a very long time, I'll just end this section with a brief summary of things I've talked to some of you about mirror neurons, and then a Princeton Theological Seminary study, and then I'll move on to the next ingredients. Here's the idea of mirror neurons. We now know that when I'm moving my hands like this, there's dedicated neurons in the motor cortex of my brain going like this. That's old hat. What research in the last decade shows is as you all look at me with your eyes, and you're all looking at me very attentively, okay? As you look at me with your eyes, you have in the motor cortex of your brain the same neurons going like this, because we're hardwired for empathy. We're hardwired for connection, but only through the visual cortex, not if you're looking down, not if you're texting. Okay? So I think that's an extremely important point, and I'll just end this with a quick study before I go on to the next D. So again, this is the E of empathy and eye contact. It goes like this. Princeton Theological Seminary. They take a group of divinity students on the Princeton campus, and they say you have to practice a speech. Half are randomly assigned to give a speech about giving chesed. It's a speech about the Good Samaritan. You know, it's not from our testament, but about somebody who stops what they're doing and helps somebody in distress out. And the other half of the seminarians are given they're randomly assigned to a speech on a non-chesed related topic. Then they tell them, okay, you're going to go to another building of the seminary and you're going to practice the speech. But again, remember, these are psychologists. They tend to sometimes be a little sadistic. And what the psychologists do is they have, halfway between the two buildings, as the seminarians are going to practice their speech, a man feign having a heart attack. So he's doubled over and he's saying, help me, call an ambulance. Then they look to see, you would think that if you're about to practice a speech on doing chesed for a bystander, you're going to stop. Turns out, you know something? What predicted whether the person would help had nothing to do with what speech they were practicing. The number one predictor as to whether or not these seminarians would help was how much of a hurry they were in. If they felt they were in a hurry, if they perceived themselves to be in a rush, they did nothing. Even they're about to give a speech about doing this, and they're practicing the speech in their head. They did nothing. The moral knowledge should not bridge into moral action at all. Because when we're in a rush, we tend not to be empathic. Okay? So that's the second E, is the E of empathy, eye contact, really connecting and taking the time to connect. Okay? The third and I think penultimate E is the E of expectation. I'll just talk to you about this a little bit. How many of you heard me talk about the monastery study? It's not fair. Who else? Who else? Anybody else hear about the monastery study? Okay, only one person. It's a great study. And yeah, we're okay with time. Okay, here's the monastery study. Rav David Cohn, when he heard me talk about this once, said that he heard about this study also, but it happened in Camp Monk. So, but anyway, so here's the monastery study. They take a monastery, and they it's no longer a monastery, and they convert it to look exactly like the world looked many decades ago. And I'll explain what I mean. They take eight men who were older. These are men who were, let's say, in their 70s and 80s, back when 70 and 80 was much older than it is today. And they changed the monastery to look exactly like the world looked when these men were 40 years old. They changed the wallpaper. They put in black and white televisions. They changed the furnishings. It's exactly the way the world looked when these men were in their prime. Okay? They take eight men. They have them spend 5 days in the monastery. And here are the directions they're given. Think of yourself as being more than half your age. Think of yourself as being much younger. Treat each other like you're 40 years old. The men were told, you know, normally we help you with your suitcases. Nope, we can't. You bring your suitcase up to your room yourself, okay? And if they couldn't do it right away, they'd do it one shirt at a time. And then they had a comparison group the following week who were treated like they were old men. And here's what they found. What they found was that just in 5 days, independent raters were universally able to pick out the men, okay, who were in the group where they thought like they were younger and treated like they were younger. They said independently, this man looks younger than he did 5 days ago. Weirdly, the men, ophthalmologists did an exam. The men in the group treated like they were younger saw more clearly. They saw more clearly. Their vision significantly improved. I don't think for very long, but they had a significant improvement. Their manual dexterity improved. And in something not reported by Dr. Langer, the Harvard psychologist who did this study, which has been replicated, and each time they replicate it, they find the same thing, including BBC in London, formerly of Europe, used to do. Okay, they find that each time Langer reported to a newspaper reporter of that time that the men, as they're waiting for their bus, okay, to go home, to be taken home, they spontaneously broke into a game of two-handed touch. These are old men. They start playing two-handed touch. They literally change. Why? Because of expectation. The power of expectation.
No, the way people treat you, then you feel
that. That's exactly it. Exactly right. That's the point. So now what does that have to do with morality and bridging the value between moral knowledge and moral action? It's exactly what Dr. Olener found. He said there was an expectation in the home of a future hero, of a righteous Gentile, that of course you're going to do the right thing. When they were asked, how could you sacrifice potentially the life of your children, the life of your wife, of your husband, how could you do that? And they said, they kind of would look confused and say, how could I not do that? That's the way I was raised. This was what was expected of me. People are people. Doesn't matter if they're Jewish. How could you not do the right thing? And when it's expected of you, it makes all the difference. Final point and then a concluding story. Here's the final point. The final point is the fourth E, right? So let's review the E's. Who wants to do it? First E was what? Explanation and ethical fading. It's really two, but I'm trying to cut down on the E's, okay? Next E is what?
Eye contact
and empathy. You guys are good, okay? Good. The third E?
Expectation.
And the fourth E is emotion and emphasis. I just made that up. But emotion, emphasis. And that, it's the reality is that That's really clearly in the research, okay? It's what do you get emotional about? What do you care about? What do you emphasize? How much emphasis is put in a family? It's what you care most about that you're going to do. You know, my parents, when I was growing up, I went to Camp Monk, actually. So when I was growing up, I would come home every year with what I saw as the Loser Award. Loser Award is this, you know, what you wanted to do was be a color war general or be best athlete or best in football, best in base, whatever it was. And I would come home with best in Midos. Okay? And I'd be so embarrassed that I'd show them this little award that I'd have crumpled up. And my mother, Allah Shalom, my father, Yibad al-Chaim, used to, they would beam. They would beam. And they'd tell me over and over again, this is the only award that we'd want you to have. And they meant it. They meant it. They meant it. And it gradually sunk in. This is what matters down the road. This is what matters. Be a mensch. Be a mensch. It's what do you get emotional about with your kids? What do you really care about? And what do you emphasize? What do you spend time on? Let me end with a concluding story from yesterday's parsha. Yesterday's parsha has it had a description of the chatzotzros. So the chatzotzros were the trumpets that were sounded when they were sounded in times of war. They were sounded when Bnei Yisrael, right, when they would set down. So what would they do? They would set down camp. So that's the tkia. Tkia is what, like when you knock the peg that would keep the tent stabilized, you would be tokay. You would put it into, it would be settling down. Then, when was the trua? A trua was either when you were moving to the next camp, or the trua was if there's a war. It was the da-da-da-da-da-da-da times of war. But we always also know that the way we adapt this on Rosh Hashanah and in general, the way it was done is every trua is followed by tkiah. So the way it would work, and the Rabbeinu Bachya has a very nice piece on this, is life is about tkiah, trua, tkiah. Tkiah. You start life. You're growing up in a neighborhood. And you feel stable and connected and nurtured and nourished wherever you are. Then, inevitably, there's a trua. It could be you're going off to learn in Eretz Yisrael. It could be you're going off to college. It could be you're getting married and you're moving. Those are the truas of life. And then, what we know, and something to think about every El and every Rosh Hashanah, at the other end, there's a new tkiah. It's reconnecting in a new key. A lot of life is how do we handle the tkiahs? How do we handle the truas? And then how do we handle the reconnection? And it's something to think about because it's about the four E's that we just discussed is all about, it comes from the way parents surround their children with a sense of stability during the good times, during the stable times, during the tkiah times. And how do we surround them with an understanding of how to bridge the gap between moral knowledge and moral action during the trua times, during the tough times that aren't so easy. And those are the times that sometimes will challenge us ethically and morally. Now I'll end with my concluding story. And again, some of you may have heard this, but it's my favorite tkiah, trua, tkiah story. It's my main area in my secular world, in the secular world is trauma. So I get invited to different places and I get involved in working with trauma situations in various parts of the world, depending on what might be going on. At least this used to be before I ended up at YU. But I've always tried to help as much as I can when there are terror attacks in Israel. And I've done work there. And I've become close to a number of trauma specialists in Eretz Yisrael because of the work we've done together both there and in other parts of the world. They're always the first on the ground anywhere, be it Haiti or be it Sri Lanka or be it anywhere. Could be incredibly proud of that aspect of our collective ethics. So I was talking to a colleague who told me the following story a few years ago. This is when, in the height of the rockets falling from Gaza into Sderot. And there was a Hasidish Shechuna right next to Sderot. And they also were under constant rocket fire. And there was a 6-year-old boy who every time he'd hear it Seba Adom, and any time he'd hear a code red, he'd go crazy. He'd go running all over the place. He'd go into fight or flight, which is understandable, you know? He would totally go nuts. There'd be rockets falling. The mother is running after him, so her life's in danger, his life's in danger, and it was a disaster. And my friend, who's an incredibly capable psychologist, was trying desperately to protect him and to get him to go into the shelter, and nothing was working. Nothing was working. Then one day, this Hasidic woman calls my friend, says, "I don't have to bring him in anymore. Thank you for all your help, but the problem's solved." She solved the problem herself. Listen to what she tells him. She tells her 6-year-old, "You know how every Elul and every Rosh Hashanah, when we hear the shofar, there are two messages that we're being given. One is, wake up, wake up. You got to act. You got to act. Seva Adom, Seva Adom. It's a time for action. We can't be passive in the face of danger. In the times of Trua, we have to move. We have to think, okay? We have to think what's the right thing to do. We can't always give in to our emotions. But the second lesson of the Chatzotzros and of the shofar is what? It's, you're not alone. We're never alone. Imo Nochi Betzara. God is with us. She's telling you, your mother is with us. You're here in the hands of God and the hands of your mother. Just let us help you get to safety. From that point on, anytime there was a Seva Adom in that shchuna, a big smile would come across that boy's face. He'd give his mother his hand, and she would calmly bring him down to the shelter in time to be safe. And that's the concluding message in terms of the four E's. So it's the message that as parents, we cloak our children in the armor that they need to deal with the ceaseless ethical challenges of life. And as we teach our children, again, what are the E's? Reminding them what matters to us. Reminding them what we emphasize, what we care about, what we're emotional about. And teaching them, above all else, to care about the other and to really connect to the other, okay? And also to expect the best of them. So with all of that, may we all be zocha to continue raising children and to ourselves in our own life to continuously bridge the gap between moral knowledge and moral action. Thank you, everybody. Thanks.